Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Today, we are exploring the ethics of spying with our guest, Cecile Fabre. Have you ever had that experience where you discover something new that has been right in front of your eyes the whole time? Maybe you noticed a beautiful door on a house you've walked past every day, or encountered a rare song that comes from an artist's catalog that you thought you knew by heart. This is what happened to me when I scheduled this episode. I've been doing political philosophy for about 30 years, and it never once occurred to me that there would be an ethics of spying. Like most of you, my ideas about spies come largely from fiction. James Bond movies, John le Carré books, the TV show Archer. What all of these sources have in common is the glorification of a certain kind of chaos. The world is a dangerous place, and our secret agents will save us from it, but wow, are they going to create turmoil along the way? They're going to lie, cheat, steal, kill, and have a lot of sex. But it's all okay because they're doing it for us. I suppose, on some level, I lazily justified this on utilitarian grounds. The evil they prevent far outweighs the bad they do. But I didn't ask any follow-up questions. Does James Bond have carte blanche to murder anyone? Or does it only apply when he's on the job, so to speak? Is it really a license to kill, or is it a license to kill professionally? And who keeps track of Jack Bauer's receipts to make sure his reimbursement requests are allowable? Our fictional world of international espionage is largely devoid of rules. Now, there's a precursor to this. There are some people who have argued that terms like rules of engagement is a misnomer because war is the absence of morality. War is what happens when there are no rules. This is not a position I hold personally, and it's famously undercut by the Geneva Convention. But there is a case to be made that the rules of war only apply when you're winning. When you're about to lose, you'll try anything to turn the tide, including firebombing entire villages or dropping a couple of nuclear bombs. Spying, however, isn't the same as war. A lot of covert actions are designed to prevent conflict or to expose wrongdoing. Consider Edward Snowden, who decided that the most ethical thing he could do was expose American national security information. The U.S. is a democracy he accused of not being suitably transparent, so he released all the documents the U.S. government wanted to hide, revealing mass surveillance programs were told existed in science fiction. Interestingly, Snowden is usually referred to as a whistleblower rather than a spy, but he ended up getting asylum in Russia, where he is now a citizen. Is he a spy after the fact? What's our definition of spy in the first place? On today's episode, we're going to talk about this complex topic. Our guest is going to take us through not just her own conclusions about the moral rules of spying, but the process through which she derived them. We'll look at what has been said about spying in the past and consider the technology we have that gathers information in ways that no one thought possible even 25 years ago. But before we begin, we should ask a basic question. Is spying so important that it should be untethered? Is the James Bond archetype attractive to us because what we really want are superheroes who protect us from getting our own hands dirty? Are the fictional characters we enjoy an implicit acknowledgement that there are things that are just too important to fail at, things that we should turn our heads away from because we are willing to sacrifice our moral authority to sleep at night? Towards the end of Aaron Sorkin's wonderful A Few Good Men, Colonel Jessup, the commanding officer of the ground forces at Guantanamo Bay, argues just this. I'll edit the monologue a little bit to avoid plot details, but here's what he said. You can't handle the truth. We live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep and you curse the Marines. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know, that death, while tragic, probably saved lives, and my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. Now, I'm no Jack Nicholson, but the words speak for themselves. Ethics are put in places as a form of social control. They speak to the faith that we can use our reason, intuition, empathy, and the better angels of our nature to grow as people and as a society. But most of the time, the world doesn't feel like it's getting better, even if it is. We experience it as just the same thing over and over: violence, conflict, chaos, and loss. And if these are inevitable, if we really are at the limit of human nature, and since there are no superheroes, maybe the thing that we want most of all is a super spy who doesn't have to turn in his receipts, a super spy who lets us close our eyes and worry about other things. And now our guest, Cecile Fabre, is a professor of philosophy and of politics and international relations at Oxford University. She's author of more than a half dozen books, including the recent Spying Through the Glass Darkly, The Ethics of Espionage and Counterintelligence. Cecile, welcome to Why.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
To our listeners, if you'd like to participate, please share your favorite moments from the show and tag us on social networks. Our handle is always at Why Radio Show. Rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or your preferred podcast platform so the others can find the show and listen to all 15 years worth of episodes for free, as well as our sister show, Philosophical Currents, at our website, whyradioshow.org. And as always, the show can only happen with your support. We exist solely on listener contributions, so please click donate in the upper right-hand corner of our website to make your tax-deductible donation through the University of North Dakota Alumni Foundation. Okay, now with business done. Cecile, I guess I want to start with the question I posed in the monologue. Is spying something that we should exclude from ethical considerations? Is spying too important to control with rules?
Well, no, on the contrary, I would say that spying is so important that it must be constrained by rules, and not just legal rules, but moral rules as well.
I think there's an insight that some people struggle with, that the more important things are, the less we want to restrict them, the more freedom we want to give people. But you're actually arguing just the opposite, right? That because Yes. It's so important, why? What is it about importance that necessitates philosophers and other people engaging on this level?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I'm not sure I agree with you, actually, that many people, you know, think that the more important something is, the higher the stakes, the less space there is for regulation. So take, for example, and it's relevant to spying, but take, for example, the act of killing. Well, it's precisely because the stakes are so high that the laws against killing are so stringent, you know, in most countries. And I dare say that a lot of people would agree with that. And in fact, likewise, you know, with the war, you know, which is largely about killing other people. And again, the stakes are so high that that is precisely why there is a whole legal system, which you referred to in your introduction, the Geneva Conventions, the aim of which is precisely to determine why and when killing in war is legally but also morally permissible. And I would say the same, you know, with the spying, and not just spying in the context of a war, but in peacetime as well. In other words, the more likely it is that you're going to harm another person by your conduct, the more important it is to be very clear as to whether or not your conduct is morally permissible.
It may be a little too soon to ask this question, but when we talk about the ethics of spying and we have government agents, yeah, are they governed by rules of justice and the government's regulations, or are we talking about personal ethics? Where does the individual responsibility meet up with the collective political responsibility?
So that's another very good question. So in many countries, there is a legal framework, you know, that regulates the activities of intelligence agencies. But those laws, like any law really, are not going to be able to help individual agents in every single case that they're going to have, you know, to deal with. So this is where it's very important for intelligence agents to have a good sense of where their moral compass is, you know, as it were. So what I've just said is a point that was made to me again and again when I was researching the book in conversations I had with former, you know, intelligence officers. You know, the point being, well, in any given situation, we know what the law of our country tells us, but sometimes we just have to decide, you know, about the extent to which this particular law applies, you know, to the case at hand. I mean, I can give you an example, you know,
sure,
if you
please.
Want. So I remember talking about a former intelligence officer. I won't tell you which country and in which a combat theater that agent was operating. But they and their colleagues got wind of the fact that a guerrilla group, an insurgent group, was operating, you know, in the area. And they intercepted communications which took the form of caller one from the group giving a series of numbers to an unidentified caller. And, you know, they were trying to analyze, you know, the intelligence and, you know, to work out whether or not the numbers could be coordinates for an attack. And at the point at which they thought, well, actually, on the balance of evidence, you know, we think that these are coordinates for an attack. We know that an attack, you know, is being prepared. So we are morally entitled and legally entitled on the basis of that intelligence, you know, to basically ask that the groups be taken out, you know, by means of a drone attack. And then one of them in that group of intelligence officers thought, well, no, hold on, we need to take a little bit more time, you know, to analyze this. So they decided to wait. And as a result, they were able to find out that the numbers were numbers of pizzas on a menu that the insurgent group had got hold of. So that communication had nothing to do with an attack. It was just, you know, the insurgents wanting to basically place an order, you know, for pizzas. And so as a result, you know, the drone attack did not take place. And those insurgents, you know, went on to live, you know, another day. So I think that's a very interesting case where, under the law, they would have been able, the intelligence officers would have been able to proceed, or rather the combat unit would have been able to proceed on the basis of the intelligence provided by the intelligence officers, but the latter exercised their judgment, you know, their practical judgment, and decided that they should wait. So I don't know whether that helps answer your question, but it's one of my favorite examples, actually, of all the stories I've been given.
It's a wonderful story because it shows how close things are, how easily
yes.
the mistakes can be made.
Yes.
So for you or for the people that you've interviewed and things like that, is the ideal spy a spy who trusts their intuition and makes that judgment, or is it someone who is completely committed to the rules that are established in advance? James Bond is famously a lone wolf, right? How
yes.
much do we want spies to be individual agents, and how much do we want them to be just arms of the state?
Well, so we want them to be both, and I think this is where the difficulty lies, right? So on the one hand, they are agents, actually not so much of the state, but of the citizenry. And I think that's very, very important, actually. You know, MI6, MI5, you know, in the UK, the CIA, you know, in the US, act for us, you know, citizens. For us, we have, you know, elected the leaders who in turn appoint officials who in turn give orders to those intelligence agents. And that's a point I keep making, and I hope we can return to it, you know, in the course of our conversation. So on the one hand, we want them to be, and to understand that they are, intelligence agents acting on our behalf, on behalf of the citizenry. But on the other hand, you know, we want them to accept and take on the responsibility of having to exercise their judgment when the legal framework which we have given them, because of the circumstances of each mission, you know, is not clear enough and has to be interpreted. For us citizens, we have to accept that we entrust those officers with what is a very onerous responsibility, and sometimes they will make mistakes, and that is something that we have to accept as well.
It's an important distinction that I'm just going to ask you to follow up on right now.
Yeah.
Why citizen as opposed to state? Because part of what I see happening in your answer is the questions that I have asked so far have been in the framework of war theory or international relations
yeah.
theory. But what you're saying is it's grounded in democratic theory, in the formation of the state and where legitimacy comes from. So
yes.
what does citizenship give us? What does the citizenry give us that my framing of the question missed?
Good. So I don't want to say that an intelligence officer is morally entitled to do what she does only if she has been authorized by democratic processes to do that. And I don't want to say it, and we shouldn't say it, because if that claim were true, then it would follow that intelligence officers who have acted upon orders from dictators can never do the right thing. And that, in fact, is not true. And, you know, we could think of examples, you know, illustrating the point. What I do want to say, however, is that intelligence agencies who are part of a democratic state, you know, act and derive their legitimacy from the fact that the state is democratic. In other words, we citizens, you know, through various democratic processes, and in particular electoral, you know, processes, indirectly authorize those intelligence agencies to act. And I think it's very important to bear that in mind for a number of reasons, one of which, and it also applies to soldiers, actually, you know, one of which is that we citizens cannot, it seems to me, entirely wash our hands of what those people do on our behalf and at our behest. There is a sense in which we share responsibility, you know, for what they do. And that is something that is, I think, relatively unacknowledged. Not so much in political philosophy, but in public discourse.
Is it, this may be too superficial a question, but is it important that the citizens not be able to wash their hands of it? Is this a key element, or is it just a regrettable side effect?
Well, I hadn't sort of the question in those terms, but I think it is a key element. So to put the point more generally, we can't have it both ways, right? So if we want to live in a democracy, and if we want to enjoy the rights and privileges that come with it, then we have to accept the responsibility that comes with it as well. And that responsibility is, amongst other things, you know, the responsibility that we share to some extent, you know, for what public officials do when they act on our behalf, and particularly when they also act in order to protect our interests.
I'm trying to figure out how to ask this question.
I sense some skepticism on your part, or maybe
no,
I'm misjudging.
It's not skepticism. I think that part of what this discussion does is force us to straddle the theoretical side of political philosophy and the applied side of,
yes.
of political philosophy.
Yes,
and so
does.
I guess the question that I'm trying to focus on is, how much is the theoretical side dealing with ideal theory and the perfect
yeah.
situation, and how much is applied non-ideal and pragmatic, and sure, we're going to be guided by the philosophy, but in the end, there's some individual judgment that has to be made.
So the distinction between the theoretical and the applied straddles, as it were, you know, the distinction between, how to put it, between ideal and non-ideal. So, you know, one way to think about this is this, you know, we have some fairly general abstract, you know, principles, you know, for example, do not lie. I very much hope we're going to talk about lying in the course of our conversation today. But
we will.
Good, excellent. That's good news. That's great. So we have general principles, right? So do not lie, do not deceive, do not betray, do not kill. Then we have to think about those principles in specific cases. So that would be the applied philosophy stuff. Okay, so how does the prohibition on lying operate in the case of spying, for example? Or how does the prohibition on killing, you know, operate in the context of war or outside of the context of war? So that takes care of the distinction between the theoretical and the applied. But on the other hand, there is another distinction which you labeled, I think, correctly between ideal and non-ideal. And so here we want to know, for example, the following. All right, so suppose there is a prohibition on lying in a particular context, and suppose that I stick to that prohibition, but the other side doesn't stick to that prohibition. Well, am I morally entitled at that point? In that non-ideal case, am I morally entitled not to stick, you know, to the prohibition, you know, on lying? So in the context of, you know, spying, there are all sorts of rules or moral principles which I think ought to regulate, you know, activities by spies. The non-ideal question is whether or not those principles continue to apply when the other side doesn't respect, you know, those principles. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and it highlights a question that I think we'll talk about after the break, which is how do we deal with, for lack of a better term, the intersectionality of the ethical problems? It's not just a problem of lying. It's not just a problem of murder. Yeah. It's not just all these things, but any act of espionage or mm-hmm. act on a foreign soil may involve all of these questions at the same time. And
yes.
Very briefly before our break, is there a hierarchy? I mean, can I even ask that question at this point where murder is worse than lying? Or is that too specific a question to ask?
No, I don't think it's too specific a question. I think it's a very good question. So in the book, I don't talk about intelligence activities which consist in killing or in torturing. In other words, I don't talk about what, to answer your question indirectly, what are the most harmful, the most wrongful things that we can do to another person, you know, killing them, torturing them. And I don't talk about this because there is a fairly extensive literature already, you know, in philosophy about killing and torture, and I didn't think that I had much to add to it. So I was more interested in trying to make a contribution, you know, not so much to the violent side of what James Bond, you know, gets up to, but to the non-violent side, which is not as bad, you know, when it is bad, but which nevertheless can be pretty bad, you know, systematic lying, deception, betrayal, and so on and so forth. Actually, it's not so much James Bond as John le Carré, whom I'm thinking of when I talk about those particular moral dilemmas.
When we come back, we'll attack all of those head on. But first, you're listening to Cecile Fabre and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Cecile Fabre about the ethics of spying. So, Cecile, what's a spy? I mean, it seems like a silly question. We've been assuming it, but philosophers love definitions. Yeah. So is it important that we know what a spy is, or is that just the competitor in me that wants to know? Tell me your foundation.
No, that's good. So I mean, in a way, yes, we do have to know whenever we conduct an inquiry, or to put it more simply, whenever we think about something ethically, we have to have a very clear sense of what it is that we are talking about. So there are many possible definitions, of spying, and the one that I adopt, it's not particularly controversial. I think of spying as the act of trying to get information about another party. So in the context of international politics, usually another country or a foreign actor, so information about that actor, which we think he or she or it does not want us to have. And so the spy is that person who tries to get that information for his or her government, and again, ultimately for his or her fellow citizens. So that's how I think of a spy.
Is spying inherently covert and deceptive? And what I have in mind is London is famously the most camera covered city in the world, and everyone's being watched, but they know they're being watched. So since they know they're being watched, are the people who look at those cameras not spies?
So I don't think they are. And again, we could quibble over the definition, but it seems to me when I think about those cameras, I don't think the police is spying on me. I think that the police is observing me. I mean, assuming that the police is manning those cameras. In fact, private actors do as well. That's a separate question. But to me, that's more observation or surveillance, rather than spying. But you might disagree with me, and so we could have a long debate about what is the correct definition. In the end, what I find more interesting is not so much the long debate about the definition, but the ethical question of whether spying or surveillance are morally justified, however we define them, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. And so let's ask the question that you have towards the beginning of the book, and it's one of the gold standard questions of philosophy, because it comes out of Kant's ethics, and it's that lying is never permissible, that lying is inherently unethical. Kant says, and we don't have to get into this, no matter what happens, you should never lie. Why might we hold that position, and how do we step away from that condemnation?
Yeah, so there are various complicated reasons as to why Kant held that view. He's not entirely consistent in the course of his works. But it's important to keep him in mind, because he's actually one of the very few moral and political philosophers to have talked about espionage specifically, and to condemn it, specifically. And he condemns espionage in really strong terms. He describes it as, I quote, "that infernal art," on the grounds that it inherently involves deception. Now, there are many reasons as to why. We tend to think that lying generally, at least presumptively, is wrong. When I lie to you, I fail to treat you as my moral equal on some views. or I make it impossible for you to go about your life on the basis of truthful, you know, information about the state of the world. And insofar as I owe it to you to make it possible for you to go about your life, I wrong you when I lie to you. Like most people, I'm not an absolutist about lying. You know, I think that lying in some cases is morally permissible. In fact, I would even go as far as to say that in a small subset of cases, lying is a moral duty. And this is what, in fact, leads me in the book, you know, to say that in some cases, espionage that does involve deception can be a moral duty, not just a permission.
Can you explain why? Or give us an example?
Yeah, so I'll give you an example. So, in fact, one of the most famous examples, which is meant to illustrate the view that lying is morally wrong, is an example that Kant himself, you know, gives us. So the example goes like this. Suppose that you are at home minding your own business, but then you notice that some person is running outside your house towards some woods. And a few moments later, there is a knock on your door. You open the door and you are met with someone who you know, and it doesn't really matter why you know this, but you know is after the person you saw running through the wood. And you also know that the person at the door is going to murder the runner if he can find him. The murderer at the door asks you, do you know where Bloggs has gone? Now, Kant says that you must tell the murderer at the door the truth, even though you know that Bloggs will die as a result. Now, I believe that you are morally forbidden to tell the murderer at the door the truth. You are under a duty to lie. And the reason is this. So it seems to me that generally we are under duties to one another to protect one another from very serious and unjustified threats, in particular threats to life. And so if, for example, I am under a duty to help you escape from a murderer, for example, by giving you a weapon or by allowing you to run through my house, then I'm under a duty to you to lie to the murderer to protect you from the murderer. In other words, if we are serious about a duty to rescue people from harm, then we need to be serious about the possibility that sometimes the form of the rescue will take will involve a lie. And it seems to me inconsistent on the one hand to say that I'm under, for example, a duty to allow the victim of the murderer to flee through my house, but I'm not under a duty to that victim to lie to the murderer.
This is super interesting that there's this tension between the duty to protect and the duty to tell the truth, in part because from any spy's perspective, there's going to be their side and the other side. And their side, they're protecting their people, and the other side, they might be endangering the people. Do we always evaluate the morality of spying from the perspective of the spy's side of things?
Yeah. We don't in war. Again, referring back to your very interesting introduction to our conversation, you know, you mentioned the Geneva Conventions. They are part of the whole legal apparatus of, you know, the laws of armed conflicts. And in the laws of armed conflicts, you know, soldiers from one side are not morally entitled to give priority to their side at the expense of innocent enemy, you know, civilians. And if we say that that's true when it comes to life or life and death, then it seems to me that it must also be true, you know, when it comes to protecting from harm or inflicting harm, which is lesser than harm to life, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense, and it leads us to one of the notoriously most difficult questions in philosophy, which is, are we looking at ethics relative to the spy's, someone's perspective, or is the issue that there is an objective truth, that we don't ask, is this moving us forward on the spy's mission? We ask, was this did this objectively save lives? Did this, you know, from a God's eye perspective, is the world safer or better or what have you? Do you need to appeal to something universal in order to evaluate the ethics of an act, or are you appealing to at least the perspective of the people who are engaged in it?
Yeah, so that is one of the most difficult questions, and it arises, as you know, not just when it comes to espionage, but for any moral issue, right? My meta-ethical view, as philosophers would say, is that there are such things as objective moral truths, that the claim, for example, that taking the life of a person who has done nothing to threaten you, deliberately taking that life, is morally wrong. Now, is morally wrong, I should say, irrespective of time and place. Now, whenever I say this, you know, people come back and say, oh, but how can you be so certain? You know, surely it depends on the particular moral code in place at the time, you know, and so on and so forth. My response to that point is to say that actually there are some particular kinds of acts, and killing and lying in some circumstances belong to that category, where there is a remarkable degree of consensus across time and space as to what is right and what is wrong. And moreover, a lot of people who argue that there are no universal, objectively true moral rules don't, it seems to me, always believe it. So take, for example, the view that a state is morally entitled to act solely in its own interests and in the interests of its citizens, such that intelligence agencies are morally entitled to do whatever will serve those interests, you know, irrespective of the harms that they may inflict on foreign actors. Well, but that seems to be couched as an objective moral truth, i.e. it is objectively the case that states are morally entitled so to act. It's not a relativist claim. It's a universal, with which I disagree, but it's a universal claim that purports to capture an objective moral truth.
I think I'm going to ask a similar, if not the same question, but in a very different way. And I want to ask you the question of political realism, because for political scientists, realists is the name for the theory. It comes from Thomas Hobbes, not important, but that what we have in the world is a bunch of individual state actors or whatever, and there are no rules that bind them all. If there are rules like treaties, then it's some sort of contract, it's some sort of agreement. And so you have this social contract model of international law. But there is no international law that is binding in and of itself, separate from what the states end up agreeing to. So the first question is spying covered by international law? And second, is the normative, the moral, the ethical binding of this law simply a matter of agreement, or are we appealing to a higher authority?
So that's another very interesting question. There is an emerging set of legal norms. It's very underdeveloped, but it's slowly emerging in international law about spying in general and spies, you know, in particular. So the question is whether or not, you know, those legal norms are morally justified. In fact, the question is rather, does it even make sense to ask whether those legal norms are morally justified? Is it not enough that they are emerging as legal norms as a result of, you know, international, you know, consensus? And my answer to that question, echoing, you know, what I said a moment ago, is that it isn't enough. In other words, you know, if we want to keep open to ourselves the possibility of querying international norms, in fact, the law, you know, in general, if we think, in other words, that it makes sense in any given case to say, oh, but that law is unjust, we have to change it, then we have to remain open to the possibility that there are norms and principles which stand outside the law, in the light of which we can judge the law. I mean, take, for example, you know, debates about the abolition of slavery, you know, in the United States. Abolitionists were not, from what I've gathered, you know, reading about this over the years, they were not saying, oh, well, there is no longer a consensus that slavery is morally justified, so, you know, that's why we need to change the law and abolish slavery. Their claim was that slavery was, always has been, an evil, and that is why it needs to be abolished.
Evil is such a good word in this context, because you're really applying something which you assert can't be set aside, can't be ignored,
yeah.
Something that has such moral power. Does this change when we're talking about technology? Up until this point, we've been talking about people as agents,
yeah.
and decision making. But we're in a world of mass surveillance. We're in a world where a camera can see a mile away. We're in a world
yeah.
where you can have an attack on a country's internet and cripple them. Are the rules different for technology? How do you deal with this as a technological problem?
So that, you know, that's another very, very, you ask really good questions.
Thank you.
This is great. So I always hesitate. I mean, it may not have become apparent to your listeners when I uttered the word evil a moment ago, but I always hesitate to utter it because it seems to me that it has to be reserved for the most serious, serious wrongdoings we can possibly imagine. Otherwise, it devalues the rhetorical force, or it weakens the rhetorical force of the word. That being said, it seems to me that there are uses of technology which could be regarded as evil. And I mean, I suppose, you know, the paradigmatic example, you know, it would be the deployment of nuclear weapons, you know, as a means to target entire, you know, civilian, you know, populations. Another example which I fear might be staring all of us, you know, in the face already, if not already now, very soon, you know, would be the use of sophisticated, you know, technology to try and deceive an entire population about the results of its upcoming elections.
Right.
And that, it seems to me, you know, could be regarded, you know, as an evil. I mean, I think what your question raises, you know, is something which I haven't yet thought very much about, is, you know, whether or not what is evil, when it is evil, is the use to which the technology is put, or whether the mere development of that technology itself, you know, counts as evil. And I'm not sure, you know, about that. You know, I'd be tempted to say that merely developing weapons of mass destruction is evil. I mean, it might be a necessary evil, but is evil nonetheless, you know, irrespective of the use to which you will put them, or might intend to put them.
I want to ask where what level our focus changes on from people to technology. So I guess the way that I'll ask, which the framing I actually got from your book, which is, if we talk about eyes and ears, people who are looking and listening themselves, is that meaningfully different than having a microphone and a camera? Does the media, does the technology, does the power that the technology have change the morality, or a camera is just a substitute for the eyes? A microphone is just a substitute for the ears, and in essence, they're the same thing.
So that I think really depends. So we, in order to answer that question, it seems to me that you know, we need to know where, as it were, are the eyes, you know, and the ears. So imagine the first pair of examples, right? Contrastive examples. And in that first pair of examples, I'm a spy. Now, case one, I observe, you know, the enemy with my eyes through his window. Okay, he doesn't know that I'm there. Case two, I have placed a camera, you know, inside his house, and I check, you know, the feed once in a while, but I don't stand behind the camera, you know, as he goes about, you know, his business. Now, it seems to me that there is no morally salient difference between those two cases. Compare with the following pair, where in the first scenario, I observe him with my eyes and with my ears, but the reason I can do that is because I live within his family. I have inserted myself, you know, in his entourage. And in the second case, I've put, you know, a camera in his house. And again, I don't check the feed, you know, on a regular basis. I do so once in a while. Now, in that second pair of examples, I think that there is a very, very important difference, which is that when the reason I can observe him with my eyes and ears is that I live in the midst of his family, I deceive him, you know, in a way that I do not when I observe him by means of a bug, you know, or a camera. So I think there is a difference, you know, between the two scenarios in the second pair.
You distinguish in the book between deep and shallow lies. What's the difference, and why is that distinction important?
I'm slightly puzzled here because I thought the distinction I drew was between deep and shallow secrets, but maybe
you're absolutely right. You did.
But let's talk about this. Actually, no, it's interesting because you just made me realize that the distinction I draw between deep and shallow secrets in the earlier part of the book, in fact, has a bearing on how we can think about lying. More specifically, so if you won't mind, I'm going to try and think aloud.
Please, that's what we like best.
Okay,
we
that's love good. That so, best. So just for the benefit of your listeners, who, you know, will not have read the book, there is no reason why they should really. But the shallow secret, you know, is a secret along the lines we do not reveal to the citizenry what the budget for intelligence agencies is. So we are open that there is a budget voted annually for intelligence agencies, but we don't give the number. So that's a shallow, you know, secret. A deep secret is one where we don't even say to our fellow citizens that there is a budget voted annually for intelligence agencies. And it's a deeper secret because by not even disclosing that there is a budget, we don't give citizens the opportunity to challenge us on what that budget is. Is that clear so far?
Yeah, let me offer a slightly different version. I'll do it in Cicela Bach's words because she was on the show a few years ago. She's wonderful.
She's absolutely fantastic philosopher. Yeah.
There's a difference between having a secret and letting people know that you have a secret, and having a secret that you keep secret. And so a shallow secret is a secret that everyone knows you have a secret. So you know there is the National Security Agency. You know there is a budget. We're just not telling you what it is. But
that's
a deep secret is a secret that we keep secret. So maybe there's another agency, you know, the National Watch People Foundation, right?
Yeah, that's good.
But we don't know it. So it's a second. There's two levels of secrets in the deep secrets. That's fair, right?
Yes, I think that's very fair. I think that's very fair, and it's a very good way, you know, to put it. So how might that help us, you know, with thinking about lying and deception in general, but also in the context of espionage. Well, so, deception takes many forms, and lying is the most obvious, form of deception, that there is. It's the one that, we think of, immediately. But of course, we can deceive other people by omission or by our silence. So here we can, again, use that distinction between shallow and deep. There is a shallow level, of silence. So we remain silent about, the budget that we allocate to intelligence agencies. But we can also deceive deeply by our silence. We don't say anything at all, about it being the case that there is a budget in the first instance for national intelligence agencies and so on. And, some people take the view that, deep secrecy or deep deception is other things equal, morally more problematic than shallow secrecy or shallow deception. And I'm very sympathetic, actually, with this line of argument.
Is there a national right to privacy? Do countries have the same kind of privacy rights that an individual has? And if so, does that change the way we should talk about secrecy and espionage and lying, because what you're doing is violating that right to privacy? How much privacy does a nation state have, so to speak?
So that's interesting. So I'm slightly hesitant to use the word privacy, in the context of a state or indeed of a community, political community, in general, partly because I am, and I guess we are so used to thinking about privacy as something that is enjoyed or not, as the case may be, by individuals. So it seems to me that secrecy might be a better word for it. But I do think, and here I know that quite a lot of my readers have disagreed with me, but I do think that there is a presumptive case for a certain degree of secrecy, i.e. for some kinds of information relating to the state, to the political community, remaining secret, such that the burden of proof, is on those who want to lift the veil of secrecy rather than on those who want to maintain it. I mean, that's something which is not often discussed, actually, in moral and political philosophy. And it's regrettable. In fact, Cicela Bock, in her wonderful books, talks about secrecy, and I'm glad that she does, though I regret that she's one of the very few who does it.
So let me ask you to clarify something. You said it really quickly, but I'll pose the question so you can offer the answer. The burden of proof is on who? The people who want to keep the secret or the people who want to seek out the secret? Who has to explain what they're doing?
So I think it's very largely contextual. And the fact that it is contextual is one of the difficulties inherent in trying to work out what should remain secret and what ought, to be, to be disclosed. So let me give you an example. It's a real life, example, and it's one of my absolute favorite examples as well. So in the years, leading to the First World War, in the context of growing tensions between France and Britain on the one hand and Germany, on the other hand, British military authorities decided it would be a very good idea to ensure that their maps of Germany were up to date. And so they set out to gather relevant information about the roads, the very nascent, railway system, but also, so this is my favorite bit, but also about bicycle shops in Germany. Well, why bicycle shops? Well, because, in the early years of the 20th century, a number of tasks within armed forces were conducted on bicycles, ferrying food, ferrying medical supplies, ferrying important messages, from headquarters back, to units on the front. So they needed to know, in order to know where bicycles could be repaired, they needed to know where the bicycle shops were. Now, in civilian times, you might think that it really should not be a military secret where bicycle shops can be found in any given place. But in a context of growing tensions, you can imagine why the German authorities would not have looked kindly on any one of their subjects or citizens, you know, disclosing to British military authorities where the bicycle shops were, particularly, you know, in the area bordering the border with, you know, with France. And so the first task, I'm sorry, this is a slightly longer answer to the question that you were looking for, but the first task really in trying to work out what has to remain secret and who decides, the first task consists in looking at the context. The second task, you know, consisted evaluating the severity, you know, of the threat that we would face if the veil of secrecy were lifted. Another task consists in ascertaining whether or not we might in fact be better off not keeping things, you know, secret. It's very well known that Winston Churchill, in the conversations he had with Stalin in the months leading to D-Day, to the invasion of Europe by the Allies in 1944, promised to Stalin that the truth, you know, about the invasion would be protected by a bodyguard of lies. And in fact, that is what the Allies did. I mean, the deception operations surrounding D-Day were absolutely extraordinary. But sometimes you want to protect the truth with a bodyguard of truth in order not to alert the other side that you might have something to hide. And this is where, you know, secrecy, in fact, is harmful to the national interest, even in the context of war.
So as we move towards the end of the discussion, I'd like to ask two questions.
Yes.
And it was actually – one of them was inspired by the fact that you say people disagree with you on some things. The first is there an overall principle or paragraph or something that you can communicate without reading the book that gives us a general sense of what your rule for ethical spying is? Is it something that you can summarize, or is it just a checklist and all very complicated and context dependent? And the second, which is a curveball, as we say in America,
yeah,
would the spy agencies agree with you or not? Not with other philosophers, but which part of it would the spy agencies want to push back on?
Good. So regarding the first question, unlike many people, or some people, including Kant, it seems to me that spying is morally justified. Indeed, in some cases, I think that it is morally obligatory. It is a duty to embark on those activities. The reason why it is morally justified, or indeed morally mandatory, is when it is used as a means to protect fundamental moral rights. So rights that we have to the freedoms and resources we all need, you know, in order to lead minimally decent, flourishing lives. So that would be my very, very brief, you know, summary statement, you know, about the morality, you know, of espionage.
So just to summarize for our guests, we have these things called fundamental rights, the right to live, the right to self-defense, the right to express ourselves, the right to religion.
That's
and what
right.
spying has to do, what makes spying a duty, a responsibility, is the state or whomever's job is to make sure we get to exercise those rights.
Yes, yes.
And that
– yes.
Yeah, please, go.
Well, so this is it's very, very important, you know, to be clear as to who – is included in the we here. So right. My view is not that, for example, you know, American intelligence agencies are morally permitted or indeed obliged, you know, to spy as a means, albeit solely as a means to protect the rights of American citizens. I think that they are morally permitted and obliged to do it also as a means to protect the rights of foreign actors, you know, when they operate, you know, abroad. So, you know, when the United States or Britain or France, you know, are at war, for example, you know, the duty to spy is a duty that their forces owe not just to their own soldiers, not just to their own citizens back home, but also, in particular, to innocent civilian members, you know, of the enemy. So that's really, really important, at least to me, and it's a central plank of my account.
It's tremendously important. It's also shifts the burden, not the burden, but shifts the perspective quite a bit. So imagine, and I don't want to get into the conversation, but imagine if you said that Israel's spying had to make sure to protect Palestinian religious rights as well as Israeli religious rights. How would that change the dynamic? If American spying has to protect the fundamental rights of the Chinese, the fundamental rights of the French, the fundamental rights of the Nigerians, along with the fundamental rights of the United States, then we start, ironically, to have spying provide a more cosmopolitan worldview than the tribalism that we get stuck in. And so that's super interesting, because you would think that spying would deepen the tribalism, but in your moral theory, it actually helps diminish it.
Yes. And so you're absolutely right. That is an implication of my view. And, you know, it need not be as controversial or dramatic as some of your listeners, you know, might think. So, I mean, I'd rather not get into the Gaza war.
No, please don't.
You know, exactly, if you don't mind. Yeah, but you know, here is an example. So, if you think that U.S. armed forces, or you know, British armed forces, or French, you know, armed forces, who are engaged in a non-conflict abroad, are under a moral duty, not just a legal duty, which they are, but a moral duty to minimize the risk that they will kill innocent, you know, civilians. And if it is necessary, in order for them to minimize that risk, if it is necessary for them to conduct espionage operations, for example, you know, in order to establish whether the intended target is a military target or a civilian target, then you are committed to the view that they are under a moral duty to those innocent civilians to spy, you know, to the end of establishing, you know, whether those civilians are indeed really, you know, civilians, you know, or not. So that it seems to me, the fact that the duty to spy is owed not just to our own side, but to the other side, straightforwardly follows, you know, from the claim that we are under duties to protect as well as duties not to harm, you know, members of other political communities, you know, than our own. So that really, you know, summarizes, you know, my view. But you're right. I mean, it weakens the dichotomous impulse that we have when we think about war and espionage, the impulse of dividing the world, you know, into us and them. In fact, a lot of my work over the years has tried to weaken that, to blunt, you know, the force of that that impulse.
Have you talked with professional spies or diplomats or anything?
I have, yeah.
How do they react to this notion?
Well, that's interesting. So, slightly to my surprise, I have to say, I have found that by and large, those I have spoken to, so to give you some context, you know, I've spoken to current officers, officers of intelligence agencies, as well as former, you know, intelligence officers and soldiers, former soldiers who used to work in intelligence gathering, deeply embedded, you know, in armed forces. And what I have found, I have to say to my surprise, is that the broad moral principles which I define in the book to them, and I'm thinking here of you know, British and American personnel, are like pushing through an open door. And I was slightly surprised. I was expecting more pushback, and particularly more pushback along the lines, it's us versus them. The pushback I have had, because I have had some pushback, hasn't been about that. It's been about how do you make sure, on the battlefield in particular, that intelligence officers can do what you, Cécine, say in the book, you know, that that they should do. The other pushback I've had, you know, has been, and it's related to what I've just said, has been on the degree to which it is possible, not just in wartime, but in peacetime as well, for an individual intelligence officer to be sure that he or she is only acting for the sake of fundamental moral rights, given that they will only be given a tiny part, depending on the level of seniority, of course, but, you know, a tiny part of the overall, you know, intelligence, you know, picture. So the pushback has been, we agree with you at the most general level, but it's much, much, much harder and much more demanding to make it work in practice than you seem to allow, you know, in the book. And I think they're right about that. So if I could write the book again, I would say more about that question, you know, the question of how you operationalize, you know, those principles for intelligence agents.
Well, if you end up writing that, we will read it and we will invite
you
on to
much.
Why and talk to you about it. This has been such an interesting conversation and such a tremendous learning curve for me to focus on something that, like I said in the introduction, I hadn't really thought about. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining us on Why.
And thank you for having me. And I've really enjoyed it and I've learned a lot from it as well. So really, thank you very much.
I'm really happy to hear that. Thank you. You are listening to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We were talking with Cécile Fabre about spying. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. I'll be back with a few more thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Cécile Fabre about spying and the moral framework that we should think about spying in and the morals that spies and nations and other agents should follow. And towards the end, as we talked about the importance of the moral rules, I had in my head this image of the new parent, and the new parent who takes their kid home and freaks out because there is no instruction book and they don't know how to do anything. And every step with your first child, especially, is this learning process. And what you are the most afraid of is not being able to be a good parent. And I create that as an analogy to the very surprising conclusion that we came to, which is that spies, agents, agencies want these rules. Because if you are a spy in the field doing something, you may not know how to do it. You may not know what lines you can or can't cross. You may not want to make those judgments on behalf of the citizens that are giving you the permission and the responsibility of doing this. The more rules there are, the better the spy can do their job. The more these issues are outlined and discussed and articulated and procedures and rules are followed, the better the spy can be and the more the spy can trust their own instinct to follow through on this. And this runs counter to especially the American sensibility. As Americans, we like to think that what freedom is getting to do whatever we want and not being held accountable. And so we want a spy to be free so that they can do whatever they want and the United States won't be held accountable. But there's a different kind of freedom, a freedom that gives us a strong sense of who we are and who we could be at our best. And I think ultimately Cecile is pulling from that tradition and saying these clear-cut rules and these clear-cut expectations make agents into better agents and the agents into better people and the countries into better countries. And that's why she insists that when you are spying for country A, you also have to think about the fundamental rights of country B, because we are human beings first, and we are appealing to the overarching morality that we are all bound by, regardless of what our job is. With all of that said, if you've been listening to this episode on Sunday night on Prairie Public, please know that a longer version with almost 30 more minutes of discussion is available online and as a podcast. Visit whyradioshow.org to listen or subscribe for free. For everyone else, rate us on iTunes and Spotify to help spread the word about the show. Follow us on all the usual social networks. Our handle is always at whyradioshow. And please help us continue broadcasting by making your tax-deductible donation at whyradioshow.org. Click donate in the upper right-hand corner to go to UND Alumni's donation portal. We exist solely on the money you provide. Thank you yet again to Cecile Fabre, Prairie Public, and especially Skip Wood, our long-suffering engineer. I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, signing off for Y Radio. Thanks for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Y is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.